Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Yesterday was kind of an interesting day harvesting because it was so cold out. Rinsing the grains in the greenhouse, my fingers were nearly frozen.
Marcia Veldman of Meadowlark Farms is selling those beautiful greens at the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market today. We'll speak with her and two other vendors at the market to see what fresh local food items are for sale during the cold months. Before that, Amy Mayer of Harvest Public Media reports on the USDA's attempt at modernizing the country's poultry inspection laws. Michael Bell is back in the second half of our show. First, he tapped the maple trees, and now he shows us how he boils the sap down to syrup. And in the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr brings a little bit of the Caribbean to our winter dinner table. But first, our food news headlines, courtesy of Mia Partlow. Welcome.
The big news this week is about a classic story of David versus Goliath. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing a case pitting Monsanto against Sanborn, Indiana farmer Vernon Hugh Bowman. The agribusiness giant says Bowman violated the patent on its Roundup Ready soybean seeds. According to NPR, Bowman bought some ordinary soybeans from a small grain elevator where local farmers drop off their harvest. He knew that these beans probably had Monsanto's Roundup Ready gene in them because that's mainly what farmers plant these days. But Bowman didn't think Monsanto controlled these soybeans anymore, and in any case, he was getting a motley collection of different varieties. But Monsanto's general counsel, David Snively, says Bowman used the technology without paying for it. Farmers who plant Monsanto seeds must sign a contract pledging to not save seeds, which requires them to buy more each year. The eventual ruling could have far-reaching implications for the biotech and technology industries as well. In a study released in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, antibiotic-resistant genes were discovered in the manure on Chinese pig farms. One half of the world's pigs live in China. Researchers say once in the pig manure, the antibiotic-resistant microbes can enter the food supply through water by way of runoff from the farm or travel by wind in humans. They say as a result, this is a global issue, not just a local one. In 2011, the FDA put the responsibility on pharmaceutical companies to voluntarily reduce sales of antibiotics to farm producers. But last year, sales of penicillins and tetracyclines for animal use doubled from previous years. And Colorado Congressman Jared Polis announced this week he would introduce a bill that would require genetically modified food to be labeled. He was joined by Oregon Democrat Peter DeFazio and California Democrat Barbara Boxer in introducing the bill. Polis argued the bill is about the right to, quote, empower people to make their own healthy choices, unquote. Opponents of GM labeling campaigns say fear of genetically modified foods is unwarranted. According to Eric Meyer of the Washington Association of Wheat Growers, labeling genetically engineered foods would infer there's a difference in those products, when, he says, none actually exists. An initiative is also currently in front of the Washington legislature that would require labeling of GM foods. Find links to these stories on our website, eartheats.org, and join us on Facebook and Twitter to get news updates like these throughout the week. Just search for Earth Eats.
The latest news from around the food world brought to us by Mia Partlow. Thanks for the work.
You got it.
Every year, more than 9 billion chickens and turkeys are slaughtered, then inspected for defects before heading to market. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is trying to modernize that inspection process, which dates back to 1950s-era poultry law. But while industry, government, and consumer groups agree that updating makes sense, there's widespread disagreement over whether the USDA's proposals will make things better. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
Phyllis McKelvey spent 44 years looking for blemishes on chicken carcasses.
I started out as a inspector's helper back when I was just practically a kid.
Later, she became a government inspector in Alabama and Tennessee. And in 1998, McKelvey became part of a U.S. Department of Agriculture trial.
I was one of the first groups of inspectors ever put on hemp.
HIMP is the acronym for the new inspection system the Department of Agriculture has been testing for 14 years. Data gathered at 20 pilot locations influenced the controversial new inspection rule USDA unveiled last year. If enacted, the changes could affect all poultry plants in 30 states, including Iowa, Nebraska, and Missouri. USDA Undersecretary for Food Safety Elizabeth Hagen says the agency's goal is simple.
We think this is a better way to protect consumers than we have done before, and that's really it. It doesn't get more complicated than that.
Among the proposed changes, for example, is a requirement that companies test for harmful pathogens. The rule also allows birds to travel past the inspector faster, and it shifts the initial sorting of birds to the companies, big ones like Tyson and smaller ones like West Liberty Foods in Iowa. Employees would remove carcasses or parts that are visibly unacceptable, so those never reach the government inspector. But McKelvey says when her plant adopted hemp, she saw company workers without adequate training making decisions she disapproved of.
And it's hard to get them to understand, you know, they want to do what their supervisor says, not the right thing. You know, if the supervisor says let it all go down the line, they let it all go down the line because that's who pays them.
It's still the inspector's job to stop such a bird, but McKelvey felt that under the hemp system, the government's authority diminished. That's one reason many people oppose the rule. Over 2,000 public comments were filed, with many protesting that companies would end up controlling inspections. The new rule also would reduce the number of inspectors on the line, cutting federal jobs. The National Turkey Federation and the National Chicken Council endorse the proposed rule. The groups say it allows inspectors to focus on details that didn't exist when the current system was created. National Turkey Federation President Joel Brandenberger says back then, visual inspection was all they had.
The time now has come to focus even more on pathogen control. That requires significant biological testing. And that is where the federal government has decided it wants its inspectors more.
Undersecretary Hagen says the data show hemp plants did as well or better than others on measures such as salmonella rates, and they did it at a lower cost. Consumer groups such as the Center for Effective Government deemed the same data inconclusive, while adding that saving money shouldn't be a motivating factor. But Hagen says in this case, efficiency and efficacy go together.
There's definitely a good government component to this, being better stewards of the taxpayer dollars that we get to do our jobs. But what's driving it is furthering our mission and continuing to improve public health.
Phyllis McKelvey, who's retired now, doesn't think that's going to happen. Under hemp, she says, too many potentially unsafe chickens get by. Last year, after the public comment period was over, McKelvey delivered to USDA a petition with over 177,000 signatures opposing the hemp rule. McKelvey does still buy and eat chicken, always washing it before cooking it.
It's going to be clean before it goes in my skillet, and it's not coming out of my skillet half done.
After 14 years of testing, the new poultry rule remains undercooked, still pending at the Department of Agriculture. But Undersecretary Hagen says it's a priority she shares with her boss, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. The Bloomington Winter Farmers Market takes place Saturday mornings through the end of March. It features about 25 vendors serving, on average, 600 customers. Today, we're featuring three of the vendors who bring their goods to market every week. First stop is to one of the busiest tables in the Harmony School Gymnasium.
I've got some of the usual.
Yeah,
one of each.
One of each. All right.
Okay.
17
Thank
bag. Thanks.
Thank
Enjoy
you.
It. Thank you. Would you like a bag?
That's Marcia Veldman of Meadowlark Farms. She's selling gigantic sweet potatoes, herbs, and greens like Swiss chard and mustard greens.
Yesterday was kind of an interesting day harvesting because it was so cold out. Rinsing the greens in the greenhouse, my fingers were nearly frozen.
And it's snowing now and it'll probably be 50 tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right.
So you've got a passive solar greenhouse.
Yes.
And so tell me how your food is grown.
Well, we have, in the greenhouse, we have raised beds. And so you have to, for growing for winter, you have to get started, and there's kind of a window of opportunity in the fall, because if you don't start soon enough and the light diminishes and it gets cold, stuff will just hang out small all winter long. So with the kale and the Swiss chard, usually mid-September, and then the lettuce and arugula and mustard greens about a few weeks later than that. This winter has been real mild, so stuff has grown better. It comes back after harvesting quicker. Good morning.
Good morning.
Those are some big sweet potatoes.
Yeah, I know. This is, but they actually taste the same. You know, some produce, okay, it makes a difference.
How do you get them so huge?
You know, sweet potatoes are a funny thing. They will vary within the same bed, so you know, presumably they have about the same level of fertility. There you go. Thanks. So yeah, presumably it's, you know, about the same level of fertility and growing conditions, and I'll lift one plant up and it'll have just like two whoppers of sweet potatoes on it, and then the next one has five skinny things on it. They're just don't know. But last year, one of the reasons I like growing a diversity of things is when the weather is so unpredictable. You just don't know what's going to happen. And for many things, last year was a tough year. It was so hot and so dry. But those are perfect growing conditions for sweet potatoes.
Hey there.
I'm Kathy Crossan, and our farm is Red Rosa Farm in Owen County.
So what are you selling today? This maybe is the most unique table at the market.
Well, thank you very much. We have the alpaca yarns. We have a herd of upwards of 100 alpacas. For years, I just had the natural color yarns, but this year I've introduced some dyed colors.
So talk me through, like, the lifespan of the yarn, how it goes from being on the alpaca to being on the table here ready to be sold.
Well, we shear in the late spring when it's reliably warm enough, but and so the animals don't get hot in the summer. And my partner, Kenny, hand shears them with just fabric shears, all 100-odd animals, just gently without restraint, because we didn't like the professional shearers who come in and are kind of rough with the animals. And we have the bags of fleece that I then combine into color lots, and I hand wash them and pick them free of debris, and then I take them in color batches to a mill.
Well, it's beautiful. Do you knit or crochet yourself?
Oddly, I don't. I have come to this from the animal side of things, and so I have to fake it that I know anything about knitting. And
I have to touch this. It's so soft. This makes me wish I knit so I could make myself some socks or something from this. Okay, so you're also selling seeds.
The garden seed have become the primary focus of our agricultural side. I've always saved seeds for myself, but about 5 years ago, I started offering our tomato seeds. And so I grow those in a two-year rotation. So we offer about 60 varieties of heirloom tomatoes. And of course, I've selected for my very favorites over time.
What is your very favorite?
I always tell people if I could take one tomato to a desert island, it would have to be the Cherokee Purple. But I now have a kind of triumvirate of favorites. The Great White is a fantastic slicing tomato. And also the Orange Russian, which is a heart-shaped bicolor. Beautiful and very tasty.
You know, what I'm also learning is gardeners look at seed catalogs and go to tables like yours and look at the seeds, and they start salivating, thinking about what they can plant and what they can grow.
Well, the seed business has become very competitive, and I know I've been getting a glossy catalog every other day from seed companies. So,
but the difference is that your seeds grown in southern Indiana, and you're
so you know
picking the seeds
here
that are going to really be hardy in this area.
They should be, yeah.
Thank you. I really appreciate this.
You are so welcome.
Christina Hunter of Hunter's Honey Farm.
And tell me what you're selling today.
All kinds of honey products, from just straight honey to honeycomb, spun honey, some sauces and marinades made with honey. I've got a few treats.
Got the honey sticks, which I love.
The honey sticks, which is a very popular item with both the younger crowd and the older crowd.
And you've got some pollen. Is that pollen that I see?
That is pollen. Uh-huh. Pollen that the bees collect from the flowers. And people will take that as a kind of like a multivitamin because it's so nutrient-packed. It's a complete protein. So, you know, you're getting all your essential amino acids there and then just loaded with vitamins and minerals.
So it's snowing outside right now. Are you harvesting honey right now?
No. If there aren't any flowers for the bees to collect nectar from, they're not making any honey, so to speak. Okay, so honey production won't start until the dandelions are usually the first flower to start blooming.
So when was the last time that you harvested honey?
In the fall. Yeah, we normally, it depends on the season. It's all, you know, it's agriculture, so you were kind of at the mercy of Mother Nature, so to speak. And if we do specialty crops, then we may harvest those two or three times during the summer. Normally, we have two big harvests, which is like summer honey, spring and summer, and then the fall crop.
Three?
23. What kind of honey are you getting today?
Half gallon of clover.
Half gallon. How long is that going to last you?
Oh, it'll probably last me a good month or so.
You must love honey.
I do. Yes, it's a sugar substitute for us at our home.
But today is not the same. Something's changed. 1001 must be my lucky number.
We're listening to the musical stylings of Jason Fickle performing live at the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market, which is open 9 a.m. to noon on Saturday mornings through March in the Harmony School. If you're looking to find a winter market in your neck of the woods, do a search on the website localharvest.org. Next week, we'll chat with a shopper at the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market who uses her SNAP benefits or food stamps to buy fresh local food for her family. Coming up.
With just one person, there's, you know, relatively speaking, you're constantly in motion because you're either splitting wood or, you know, feeding the fire about every 8 to 10 minutes.
Michael Bell is back to show us the next step in making maple syrup. After having collected gallons and gallons of sap from the trees at the Hinkle Garten Farmstead, he's now keeping himself very busy boiling it down to syrup. We visit him busily working in his sugar shack up next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The other day, I was here for about 10 hours, and we boiled about probably 75 gallons of sap down to about maybe about 15 gallons.
This is 10 hours straight?
Yeah. It's a marathon.
Do you have a book or something?
Mike Bell doesn't have a book, but he does have a radio to keep him company. He spends most of his time these days hunched over in a makeshift sugar shack in the backyard of the Hinkle Garten Farmstead. He doesn't seem to mind the long hours, though. And once you get close enough to the bubbling pans of maple liquid, you can understand why.
Ugh, what a smell. I wish that this could be my office for 10 hours a day.
Right.
Steam is wafting off this. Can you describe what's going on in these bubbling vats?
Yeah, what I've got here is what they call a maple syrup evaporator. And it's a decidedly low-tech one that I basically just hacked together out of an old legal-size filing cabinet. Got the drawers out of it. It's face down. I cut the back of it out and got a barrel stove conversion kit. So we have a fire door at the back, a damper at the far end, and then it's lined with ceramic blanket and fire brick.
You were talking when we were tapping trees about how you want to try to be as authentic as possible to how they would have done this back in 1886. Obviously, they didn't have filing cabinets back then like we have, but what would their setup have looked like?
More than likely, they would have been boiling in a big cast iron pot. And with that, you know, you're just sort of constantly adding fresh sap to that. So the product that they would have would be very, very dark and have a very, very distinct maple flavor.
So are you just, do you just sit back and sort of watch it go?
With just one person, there's, you know, relatively speaking, you're constantly in motion because you're either splitting wood or, you know, going over to the wood pile and bringing a wheelbarrow load over. Feeding the fire about every 8 to 10 minutes. It's not like a wood stove where you stick a big log in and you have this nice gentle fire that burns for hours. This is almost more like a blast furnace. I mean, you want an awful lot of heat. The whole thing with the boiling is that it's a function of surface area. There's the surface area of the pan that's in contact with the heat that transfers more heat into the sap. Thus, you're boiling off, evaporating more water. And if you think about the typical ratio of 40 to 1, 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup, you have an awful lot of boiling to do. And that was never driven home to me so much until that first year when we were boiling inside. Because the rule of thumb is 1 square foot of surface area will boil off 1 gallon of water per hour. So if you have a 14-inch pot, that's 1 square foot of surface area. 1 gallon of syrup, you've got 40 hours of boiling on your stove.
Did you think you had to be like a physicist a little bit to do maple syrup? There's a lot of math in this too.
There is, you know, a little bit of science.
If you need to do something, please go right ahead.
Probably should check the fire door. I haven't thrown a lot of wood in there in the last few minutes, so. Yeah, there's our fire door there. And just, you want wrist-sized pieces of wood split down fairly small. And they're going to burn pretty quick, which is the idea, because you want this thing to be hot, hot, hot.
In addition to looking at color and consistency, he's constantly measuring the maple liquid to judge its progress. He knows he's reached syrup when it measures 66% sugar content. One vat off to the side contains sap that's been lightly boiled, giving it a golden hue.
Tools of the trade over here, what they call a sap or syrup hydrometer. It's basically just a, you know, like a Pyrex test tube that's got a scale, leaded on one end to sort of drop it in. So fill that up with some of the just slightly boiled sap. Drop the hydrometer in. Watch it bounce up and down and settle. It's almost 5%. So this started out, this barrel of sap that we started out with was like 2.6% when we started. So I've not quite doubled the sugar content on this.
A long way to go.
In a couple weeks, Michael Bell will be bottling the syrup and selling it at the Hinkle Garten Farmstead so you can taste the fruits of his labor. Keep an ear out right here for that final installment in our look at the process of making maple syrup. In the kitchen now with Chef Daniel Orr, Marcia Veldman was selling gigantic sweet potatoes at the market earlier in the show. So let's cook with a couple of those.
All right. Well, this is a recipe coming from the islands. I worked on Anguilla for 2 years, and I had a lovely cook down there. Her name was Athena, and she was Jamaican. And this is her West Indian slam and yam salad. You know, this is another version. A lot of people think of, when they think of sweet potatoes, they just think of mashed sweet potatoes or real sweet ones with marshmallows on top. But sweet potatoes are used all throughout the Caribbean as what they call a provision. And provisions are all the root vegetables that stretch out the meal. You know, taro root or the yams or even tapioca root. So you can just have your 3 to 4 ounces of protein and then have larger portions of the provisions and the good leafy vegetables and that kind of thing. We're going to start, instead of using oil in this, we're going to use coconut milk. And this is the full-fat version, so if you're going to be on the skinny, you can buy the light version, but it just doesn't have quite as much of the kind of the mouthfeel that we're looking for in this. Okay, our acid today is going to be lime juice. Okay, we're going to add some red onion, one red onion sliced. All right, and then we have about two large sweet potatoes. They're cooked and diced.
Skins are off.
They are peeled. If you do want to get that fiber, you can throw in the skins too. It's not going to hurt anything. I just like the presentation of this a little better. We've got about a half cup of chopped mint, one of my favorite herbs. Again, roughly chopped. I don't ever chop my herbs real, real fine because I think they get lost in a dish. Okay, some Italian parsley, again, roughly chopped. Scallions. We want to add a touch of sweetness, so we're going to add honey. If you wanted to make this vegan, you could, of course, add agave nectar. We're going to stir this all around, and I'm going to finish this with just a little bit of sherry vinegar. This is a Spanish sherry vinegar. It's called Xerez, X-E-R-E-S, and it's got a really nice kind of smoky flavor from the sherry casks that the vinegar is aged in. If you don't have the sherry vinegar, you could just add a little bit of cider vinegar. Okay, I'm going to add a couple teaspoons of curry powder, getting to that West Indian flavor. And then finally, we're going to season it with salt and pepper.
I can already tell I'm going to love this.
Yeah, and a great any time of the year. Okay, let me give it a little taste. The coconut milk and the honey really play off the natural sweetness of the sweet potatoes. So let me put this on a plate, and then I'm going to sprinkle it with some coconut so it gives a little bit of crunchiness to it. You can just put it on some lettuce, a little bit of cilantro, garnish it with some limes. We want to spoon over a little bit of that nice dressing from the bottom of the bowl. And you got a perfect starter, and heck, I think that'd probably cost you $1, $1.50 to make it home.
This was one of those addictive dishes that the crew and the restaurant staff just kept coming back to over and over. And I'm pretty sure the plate was completely clean by the end of it. Try it out for yourself. Find the recipe on our website and take a listen to our first conversation with Michael Bell as he tapped maple trees. There's lots of fun stuff happening on eartheats.org these days. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Mike and Danielle Bell, Aobon Binder, Kathy Crossan, Sarah Gordon, Christina Hunter, Liz Leslie, Mia Partlow, Daniel Orr, Marsha Veldman, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for listening. Till next week, happy eating, folks. I'm Annie Corrigan.